Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's hosted by me, Kyle Sconewill, and my longtime friend, Robbie Earle. Today is special because it's a Tuesday episode, which almost never happens, and I love that. But also, today we return to the glory days of Friends from Work. That's right, our favorite movie of all time, Thor: The Dark World. If you've been listening to our podcast for a long time, you know that is a running joke that we love. But you're here today probably because you haven't been listening to our podcast for a long time, in which case we thought as you're going through your rewatch of Thor: Dark World that it would be fun to play you a remastered version of our Thor: Dark World episode we recorded a year ago.
Yeah, this is one of the really fun moments that we had as a podcast, because when we started this, I had told Kyle, we both knew and still know that Thor: The Dark World is towards the bottom of the MCU pile. But when we started this podcast, I kept telling you that
you defended it at all costs.
I did, because I was like, oh, all right. Like, I'm not trying to say that this movie is good, because it's not. But
we had this running joke that you like worked it in every time, that or Captain Marvel. It'd be like, we'd be talking about, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, and you'd be like, and that's kind of like in Thor 2 and this and this and this. It's like, what, bro, stop bringing it up.
But, you know, it can't be denied. Once we got to it, you realized it's a fun rewatch. Especially, by the way, especially like, for Loki. And I think we said this in the episode. I actually think in some ways this is my favorite version of Loki that we get.
Yep.
Even with, you know, it's not the best movie he appears in, obviously. But right. I really think that Tom Hiddleston nailed it here.
I remember being really pleasantly surprised, where I basically said to you, look, it was a pretty fun rewatch. Like, I haven't rewatched it that much, but again, you made the comment yesterday in that, you know, Winter Soldier in some ways is a little more work to rewatch. And I think that's because the nature of the film, it's so much better. It demands your attention, right? Like, you got to turn off the lights. You got to watch it. You got to be focused in. These movies, Thor: Dark World and Thor 1, they're pretty easy just to throw on the background while you're doing some work on your phone or your computer. And like, it's just kind of funny. It's entertaining. I don't know. I ended up liking it way more than I remembered liking it. So you were right there.
Thank you. And I hope that our listeners, that you guys have gotten the chance to go back and rewatch the movie. And if so, then we think you'll enjoy this episode. If not, then hey, maybe we can do a little bit of the heavy lifting for you here. But before we get into that, we do, as promised, have another edition here of the hip comic Robbie's recommended reading. And as we're marching through some comics to read to help prep you for the show, yesterday we started out with the JMS Quapel Thor run there from the late 2000s, and that leads perfectly into today's, if you're following up on modern Loki. If you want to go and pick up a copy of Journey into Mystery by Kieran Gillen. That takes place pretty much directly after that JMS run. There's a bit of Matt Fraction, Thor, written in there as well, which if you aren't familiar with Fraction, he's another one of my favorite writers. He's super funny. That Thor run is maybe a bit less consistent, but what happens with Loki there, especially with Gillen and moving forward, really starts to change the way that the comics conceive of that character in a way that I think is going to come into play a lot in the show. And that kind of what Kyle, you and I were talking about with, you know, sort of is Loki destined to be straight up evil? Like, what does it mean to be the god of mischief? And you start seeing different terms thrown around for kind of what exactly Loki is the god of. And the recommendation that we'll have tomorrow really sees that in full swing in one of my favorite runs. But we'll save that. So come back tomorrow. In the meantime, head over to hipcomic.com/FFW. That's HIPCOMIC. And look up Journey into Mystery by Kieran Gillen. You can start with the complete collection, volume one. There are a couple of volumes there. I believe there's also an omnibus out there, or it's really easy on HipComic to just find these single issues. Like we've said before, this is a great way to get your comics online really conveniently while also supporting some of the local comic book shops and sellers that utilize that platform.
The entire time you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, did you say this was written by Kieran Gillen? Nebula? Nebula wrote this comic? Then I was thinking, what would a comic from Nebula's perspective be like? That's what I was thinking the entire time you were talking.
I honestly think that every time that I look at that author's name, but it is, they surely share nationality. So, I mean, maybe there's a bit of shared perspective.
Maybe. Well, anyways, without further ado, just to keep you on the end of the joke, you know, inside jokes, love to be a part of one someday. Here is our edition of Thor, The Dark World.
Thor, The Dark World was released in 2013. It was preceded by Iron Man 3, followed by Captain America, The Winter Soldier, and release order. This movie was directed by Alan Taylor. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's famous more for his TV directing than for his film direction. Most prominently, he directed some of the early episodes of Mad Men and some of the early episodes of Game of Thrones, the latter of which you certainly see him channeling here. This movie, interestingly, is written by, again, Christopher Markus and Steve McFeely. And Kyle, I've got to stop here for a second because I had sort of a revelation as I was coming into this. I mean, it's not anything super groundbreaking, but, you know,
well, then it's not a revelation. Okay, please share.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, obviously, I've been aware of this for some time, but kind of thinking back to the Captain America episode, I'm realizing that for better or for worse, I just love these guys' writing style. It really connects with me. It always has. I've always kind of been the guy that, as much as I think that Guardians and Thor Ragnarok are probably the objectively funniest movies in the MCU, and I'm not going to argue that, I always have really liked the kind of banter that they write. Like, some of the scenes in Civil War that they write really make me laugh out loud, and the same with Infinity War. And I think that while it's certainly not to that level in this film, you get a little bit of it, and it's just, I really like the movies that they write. And this is a movie they write. And I like it.
You're not crazy. I like him too, Rob. It's all right.
Yeah, and that's actually one of my big what works for this movie, or at least different variations of that are what I think work really well. Like, I think the dialogue is both pretty funny at times, and I think we get some really good lines, particularly from Loki in this movie. I think that I didn't really look back on it that way until this later rewatch. And maybe, again, it is sort of something to do with a post-Avengers mindset. But, like, there are some lines here that just crack me up. Like, whenever the jailbreak is going on, the one guy yells, like, it's as if they resent being in prison, which I think is funny. I think whenever Thor and Jane are walking through the cave right before they're about to get transported back, You hear Thor like mutter, "Why are there so many shoes in here?"
Yeah.
And like, I think just a little thing, it's such a different style of humor from Thor Ragnarok. And again, I would not say it's at all as funny as Thor Ragnarok, but I think that it's much funnier to me than the first Thor movie. And just the dialogue, I think that's the biggest thing for me here in general. The writing makes everything feel way more settled in to where, like, even though there are massive issues that we'll get to, I feel like the issue that I think was the biggest distraction for me in Thor was that things just didn't feel like they totally clicked, particularly with Chris Hemsworth and Natalie Portman's chemistry, which isn't totally fixed here, but even just like all of the character interactions, they just felt a little bit wonky. And that is a problem I don't think is present here nearly as much. What do you think?
It's funny because I think for a lot of people, Ragnarok felt like such a left turn humor wise, but really, yeah, you're right. These first two movies, but especially this one, have a lot of bits of humor in it that make Ragnarok not feel so out of place.
Right.
So that's my response to the humor. The Loki thing I wanted to touch on too. I just think it's noteworthy to appreciate how much his character has grown since the first one.
Yeah.
I didn't fully appreciate that in the past, but from the first movie, Tom Hiddleston a little overacts it.
Yeah.
And the character's motivations are a little bit questionable.
Yeah.
But through the whole context of the Avengers and now this movie, it's a lot more of a developed Loki by this point.
Right.
And I appreciate that.
I mean, I'll say, I think Loki is the best thing about this movie. I think this is my favorite version of Loki. Whereas I think Thor is stronger in Ragnarok forward. And I think you'll probably disagree with this. I actually think this is Loki at his best. He's evil and he's wily and he's angry and he's sort of crazy. And I just think it's exactly what I want from him.
Yeah, I remember him being just kind of mischievous in the past. That's how I viewed it. These last two movies, I get more of an appreciation for his just sheer darkness. A subtle scene that I love is that shot of him when he's just putting on the mirage, and then you see the real Loki and he's super depressed about his mom.
Yeah.
The way he plays his emotions with his parents, there's a lot of layers to it, and I really like it.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. I mean, it's the first scene, and it's why I really like having this movie right after the Avengers, is because, I mean, one of the last things you see is Thor leading him away in chains. And then after the prologue here, you see him walking into the throne room in chains. And I love that conversation with Odin and that line at the end. It's not that I don't enjoy our little talks. It's just that I don't enjoy them, actually. And I think, like, that's the kind of writing that I really like from these guys, and that I like seeing that version of Loki. And it is very much, they did a great job of kind of continuing the version of him that we got in Avengers rather than the version of him that we got in Thor. But my thing is, like, I think it sort of goes back to some things that we said with Cap, right? Where I think we talked about how even if Captain America the First Avenger isn't your favorite version of Cap, I think that the later versions don't make as much sense if you don't have that kind of classic iteration. I think similarly, you know, we always talk about me liking the quintessential versions of characters, but I think that while it's kind of fun seeing Thor and Loki come to terms with whatever their relationship is by the end of Ragnarok, I don't think that that works as well if you don't get him being kind of full on just totally unpredictable and crazy and evil Loki here. Because I wasn't a huge fan, especially on the rewatch, of really what the first movie did with his character. And this is controversial because Loki is often seen as one of the best part of the Avengers film. And I think that that's fair. But I actually like Loki here more than in the Avengers. I think that he's a little bit better written, and I think it's better acted. And it resonates more with me for whatever reason.
Okay, so moving on, one thing I really enjoyed, because I always bring this up, were the visuals.
Yeah.
The visuals are significantly upgraded from Thor 1, in my opinion.
Without a doubt.
Asgard, in general, is a way less, like, shiny version of it.
True.
It is a more realistic-looking version. But I was just kind of blown away in general by a lot of the action sequences, the fighting. It all looks way better than Thor 1.
Right.
And I kind of want to draw a line right here from this movie going forward, because I feel like every movie about made from this point on has solved a lot of the visual complaints I have.
I think that's right.
So anyways, most of the visuals that I'm going to comment on from now on are just a higher level to me than the first few movies. And maybe that's just because they're not quite as dated, and that's all. But
right.
The action sequences are really cool, and you get some like landscape far away shots that are really cool that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know that one of the complaints of this movie has actually been the visuals, not in that they look cheesy, but that it's just kind of too gritty, which I disagree with. I mean, I think people fault Alan Taylor for bringing in a little bit too much of season one, season two Game of Thrones vibes. But I kind of like that we see Asgard beyond just the palace. And another thing that I like is...
Well, it's definitely, it may not be too gritty in my opinion, but it is definitely a stark contrast from Thor 1.
Right.
So I can see why it's so different.
Right.
But I think I just prefer this.
I think I do too. I also prefer the costume design here. I think that it, for whatever reason, I mean, they're similar costumes, yeah. But I feel like in Thor, they stood out as being kind of ridiculous, and here I never had that thought watching it. All it feels like it fits, even in the context of Earth, whenever you have Thor and Malekith in their final battle. I think everything just, there's nothing that's visually striking in a bad way.
So another thing that I thought this movie did a lot better than Thor 1 is they kind of fixed the team dynamic thing I was complaining about.
Yeah,
I know they changed out one of the actors. But in general, it's a lot more natural feeling. There's more chemistry between all of them. And I appreciate Thor's team's roles better in this movie than the first one.
Part of that to me, I think, is just Chris Hemsworth is much better in this movie than he was in either of the previous films, which again, I know is kind of controversial because most people would rank Avengers far above this. But I don't know, Kyle, it's funny because I know that Chris Hemsworth has gone on record saying that this is his least favorite film he's been in the Marvel Universe. And so you would expect him to have kind of phoned in his performance. And I really don't get that. I think that he does a great job here. And
Hemsworth's progression has been very linear so far for me. It's a step-by-step thing, and I agree with you.
Yeah.
His least clicked-in role was Thor 1.
Totally.
He took a step up in Avengers, and this feels like a step up too.
Yeah.
And then I think we're going to get an even better step up in Ultron and then Ragnarok.
Oh, absolutely.
And then ultimately, the highest acting is those last two movies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think he, from especially from Age of Ultron, it's each movie is a leap ahead.
Right. So I agree with you. It does feel more natural than his past things.
And there,
although Avengers is a better movie, obviously.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He feels more natural.
There are just some, also the fanboy in me, there are just some very cool Thor moments here. And I'm not sure I really got the kind of Thor moments that I wanted, especially not in the first Thor. We definitely got some in Avengers, but you know, here it's like, you know, the scene where they hear that the prison breakout is happening,
yes,
and he jumps off the balcony and catches Mjolnir.
That's what I was going to point out.
Oh, it's so cool.
And he flies.
Yep.
Yeah.
I love it so much. I love the opening battle in Vanaheim. I think it's really fun there, kind of seeing him full out battle mode, kind of in the fantasy context. I feel like that's what they were going for in the Frost Giant battle at the beginning of Thor 1.
Right.
And I don't think that it worked nearly as well there.
Some of his lightning strikes are so cool too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I thought a really fun practical thing with Thor was, I thought it's kind of fun to see the hammer going all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of a funny thing because you never put together how is it actually getting places.
Yeah. No, I like that. Speaking of the hammer, another one of the things that I think worked here is that this movie works well as a post-Avengers kind of dealing with the fallout of the Avengers now being a thing movie. And...
Yes.
I think, you know, we'll really get that here, and then we'll get that in a very different way in Iron Man 3 a few movies from now. But I like that. You know, we've talked a lot about how I think it's important for the events here to have consequences. And I like that by the time people are seeing Thor fighting in London, he's a celebrity. Everybody knows who Thor is. And that line where Jane's trying to get the kids to leave, and he's like, that's Thor out there. He's waving his hammer around and everything. It's like, that's what it would be like, I feel. I mean, you know, to the degree that they're kind of playing within these rules, I think that that's what would happen if you saw a superhero.
The events of New York end up having massive consequences going forward, and I kind of like how Phase 2, a lot of the movies deal with that,
right.
And then to comment on how it feels real, I agree. That's one of my favorite things about some of these movies is when you sit back and you think, if the Avengers were real, what are things that would happen? How would this feel? What would this be like? I had this conversation with a friend in the car the other day. Like, if you literally had an Iron Man suit, for example.
Right.
Would the government try to take it away? They can't just have someone flying around that has that ability, right?
Right.
It makes sense.
Right.
And with this stuff, I like it. Like, if you just saw Thor on top of a building shooting lightning in New York, and now he's just walking around in town, you'd be like, oh my gosh, that's Thor.
Right.
Can I get a picture? Like, so I agree. I do enjoy that kind
of
stuff.
And speaking of the aftermath, I also really like where they took Selvig's character after he's had his mind taken over by Loki and the Mind Stone. Like,
Interesting.
I like that he is, this is maybe up for debate.
I didn't know how to feel about that.
I was a fan. I think that it makes sense. I mean, he's not like
Hawkeye.
But
what about Hawkeye?
No, but he's not like Hawkeye because Hawkeye is this, he's a soldier. I feel like as a SHIELD agent, you have to probably go through all sorts of training to kind of deal with traumatic instances like that, that a physicist mm-hmm. would not have. I mean, he's not going to be prepared to deal with the aftermath of an Asgardian god mind invasion.
Right. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. I was just kind of neutral on it. Speaking of character growth, though, one of my favorite things about this movie is that we get to see somewhat of a flawed Odin.
Yes. I'm so glad you said that.
So,
yeah.
Odin is a character in Thor 1. He's a god. He's untouchable. He knows it. And we see very little vulnerability from him.
Right.
I like that you start to see this, this jaded version of Odin who is overcompensating and ultimately making poor decisions because he can't see past his own emotions. And I like that because you start getting a vibe of where Thor gets it from a little bit.
Yes, no,
and And you start to see why Loki has a point with some of his stuff.
Yeah.
Because Loki constantly says, like, he attacked New York just like Odin does with any other planet and all this stuff. And you start to see this glimpse of, like, I think he's wrong, but he's not 100% wrong. Odin's not flawless.
Right.
And so I like the growth we get actually from Thor and Loki just because we'd start to see these chinks in Odin's armor.
No, I mean, I like that for two reasons moving forward. One, I think that Odin's reaction to Frigga's death is going to be very similar to Thor's reaction to being defeated by Thanos in the way that he,
that's deep.
Like, I think you see some foreshadowing there.
Sets him on a bad trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, they respond in very similar ways where that you act very rashly and very aggressively. And I think the second thing that I like about that
On the aggressiveness, like when he says, what are they going to do if Malekith sends the whole army? And he's like, then every drop of Asgardian blood will be, spilled or whatever, blah, blah, blah. He says something like that. And it's the same kind of Thor, like way too aggressive type stuff.
Well, no, I mean, it's funny, right? Because I think Thor's arc is so complex and so great because he's still at this point in kind of this more enlightened place that he came to at the end of the first Thor movie. And I think gradually, in some ways, he's going to regress and then kind of progress beyond even where he was originally. But so Thor is telling Odin, how does that make you any different from Malekith? And Odin's response is, well, the difference is I will win.
Oh, it's Thor right there. That's early Thor.
It is. Yeah. It's like how similar is that conversation to the conversation that you'll later get
Rocket.
Between Rocket and Thor in Infinity War.
Yes, Rocket, Thor.
Isn't that great?
We're having revelations together at the same time. I love it so much.
The second thing that I like about seeing that side of Odin is it barely paves the way for one of the big points in Ragnarok, which is that Asgard is not innocent.
Ooh, like Hela says.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I think one of the big themes,
right,
and we'll talk
about
that later.
They're not like angelic beings that just know all at all times.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to your point, Loki in some ways is just being more honest about what Asgard has been.
Right. Ironically, Thor is the one that's kind of talking them both off a ledge a little bit. Like when he even talks about how Loki treats humans so differently.
Right.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's funny because we get that line at the end from Thor where he says, Loki, for all his grave imbalance, understood rule as I never will.
Yes.
I don't know. Gosh, there's so much in this movie that I think, because even that line, Kyle, so much of Thor's story from Ragnarok onward is him not understanding rule and not really being in a position to lead. I mean, which is why he winds up making the decision he does at the end of Endgame. And I just, right. I think that there's just a lot. Oh, there's a lot here. And I think that maybe that's because you have the same writers as those later films where they were very aware of what they'd done with the character and they were kind of honoring that. But I feel like there are a lot of seeds planted here.
Mm, no doubt. And I didn't realize that until I just rewatched it. So
yeah,
I'm with you. It made a massive jump in my book. Dude, how dope is the Heimdall takedown scene of the Dark Elf ship?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's great.
Oh,
I love it.
Yeah, that's dope. Oh, I love it. I love the dynamic of him and Thor in all of this. I love the dynamic of them at like the restaurant where Thor is telling him Odin's, whatever rage is blinding him from making the correct decision. And then Heimdall then turns himself in because he still feels the need that he has to. I don't know. I like that dynamic between the three of them.
I feel like I was watching this with my wife last night and I turned to her as we were getting to this point in the movie and I told her that I think from that moment on, Thor the Dark World is actually one of the stronger Marvel movies.
Okay.
And she kind of dutifully, she was dutifully like, oh yeah, totally. And then went back to what she was doing and not paying attention at all to this movie that she doesn't care about.
Easy on the hype train. Easy.
Okay, listen. When you hear my ranking on this movie, it is very, very reasonable. I'm not out to raise any eyebrows. All I'm saying is I think that there is at least a slice, if not the whole thing, but basically the entire sequence of them breaking Loki out and leaving Asgard and going to do the exchange with Malekith, I think it's a really, really well done sequence. And those are my favorite Loki Thor scenes that we ever get. Some of my favorite lines are in that section. And I just think it's really fun. And I think it starts in that scene that you were talking about where they're kind of laying out the plan and you see them also going through all of the steps.
Right. No, I think it's good for sure.
Hey, one more thing that worked.
I have a massive thing I want to share first in case you're about to say
okay,
it.
Okay.
The audience knows they've heard me complain about deaths a lot.
That's what I was about to say.
Yes, dude, we're on the same page with this. This is weird. I swear, people, we don't talk about this ahead of time. just to give his mother a massive death with a huge funeral with incredible score to accompany it.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, Marvel, for giving me a death. This, we're what, movie 8? And I really haven't felt one like I felt this one.
Yeah.
So I just really appreciated it. I need more of this in these movies.
Yeah.
But, this is a death that proves to be even more significant in the future. So,
oh, totally. And Kyle,
I really enjoyed that.
How, I don't know about you, but that moment of Thor getting there just too late.
Brutal.
Oh man. It's like, I mean, he gets there he still is able to hit Malekith like full on with a lightning blast, but it's just like
yes.
Man, Kyle,
it's such a cool thing to include, by the way. I didn't notice it burns his face.
Yeah.
Which is dope.
Yeah. Kyle, it's this, oh my gosh. It's the same thing that happens with Thanos.
Dude, you're kind of right.
Right?
He gets there a little late, yeah.
Man, I said that I think Loki is the best part of this movie, which I'll stand by, but I think the second best part of this is what Frigga's death means for Thor moving forward and how from here on out, his story is a tragedy.
Right, and that healing he gets with her in Endgame is like the driving force to him getting back on track.
Yeah.
It is a tragedy from this point on. It goes horribly wrong.
Right, which is it's funny to say that because Ragnarok is arguably the funniest Marvel movie, but I still think that...
Right, the movie itself is funny, but the character growth is ultimately a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, just because we've brought this up in a lot of other episodes and we are musicians, I just got to give a quick shout out to the music here. I think this is the best Thor music we get. at least so far. And we've talked a lot about how up until certain points, we haven't had massive themes that are memorable,
yeah.
Which is why we give out our Alan Silvestri shout outs because those are amazing. But I really like what I get here.
No,
I like the theme I get, and I love the death scene and how they bring that theme back up.
Yeah.
So I just a little quick shout out to the music. I think it is a step up from Thor 1, and I enjoy it.
I agree. Brian Tyler is sort of the unofficial composer of Phase 2 because he does this film, Iron Man 3, and parts of Avengers Age of Ultron. And I don't think I've scored anything since. I don't know why, but it's kind of funny because he really scored the snapshot of the MCU. But I really like what he does here.
Yeah, I really like it too. It's funny how these episodes can take a life of their own, Rob. Like, for example, I just have to point out, like, we just spent, you know, whatever it was, 20 minutes gushing about how much we like this movie. And then we're going to get to the rankings. And ultimately, I'm not going to have it very high on my list. And then, like, Captain Marvel, we spent a lot of time complaining about it. And then, spoiler alert, like, at the end, Captain Marvel's ranked higher than this movie.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the expectation drives the vibe I approach this with. Like, this movie, I just remember it being terrible. So I was so pleasantly surprised when it actually exceeded my expectations. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
whereas Captain Marvel, the longer I sat with it, I had more questions with it. And it's still a better movie than this one.
Right.
But this movie in general just surprised me. And so I think that's why it has such a positive tone so far. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think it's interesting too, because while this is generally considered one of the worst, if not the worst, Marvel movies, I think moving forward, almost everything that we'll watch is just great. And so I think it's going to make these rankings interesting, is my point, because I think after this, we have all of the quote unquote bad Marvel movies behind us.
Yeah, that's so interesting. In hindsight, the universe got off to a tiny bit of a clunky start at times.
Right.
And really from this point on, we do get a lot just higher quality of a movie, you know,
right.
Movies.
Well, and I think to your point with Captain Marvel, I think one of the things that's interesting as we go forward with the MCU is we might down the line get a movie that does for Captain Marvel what Endgame did for Thor Dark World.
That's very true and interesting to think about.
You know. Because I do think...
There's a little bit of the Captain Marvel thing. It's not the Captain Marvel episode, but there's a little bit of it that she's just had one movie. We don't have... Yeah, we don't have the luxury of the hindsight yet.
Right.
Because even Thor 1 is not as good as this one, I think, now.
I agree. Well, and I think that a lot of what we're pointing out and a lot of what we enjoyed about this movie comes from hindsight.
Well, and it's because at this point, the movies have been so good from like mid-phase 2 on... That the bar has just been raised.
Yeah.
We expect a better movie.
That's true.
Sorry. We just expect a better quality movie, not than Captain Marvel. I just mean, in general, our bar is raised.
That's true.
But anyways, before we get into the bads, can I just ask you some questions? I wrote side notes and I just wanted to ask you a few things. Just briefly answer some of my questions for people.
Okay.
Because they may be thinking the same thing.
Okay. Hit me.
One of my side notes is not a question after I just set that up. But whenever the Marvel theme starts, I'm like Pavlov's dogs at this point. I get so fired up to hear that little intro theme and the comic strip thing scrolling through. I'm as excited. Like, it just gets me going.
Well, no, it's
so
funny that
much.
You say that, actually, because this is the first film where that shows up.
No, they did it in Avengers, I think.
No, I think Brian Tyler wrote that little Marvel flip score.
That's cool. I love it.
Yeah, I do too.
Okay, so some side notes. Sorry, I got distracted there.
Yeah, no, you're good.
What is the deal with the Bifrost? Did it just get rebuilt and that's the expectation?
I think that's the understanding. I think that it's been...
Why is that not addressed more?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's something that
It's such a big deal in the first movie that you're not going to be able to travel.
Isn't that interesting?
And then the very
too?
Next movie, we're just seeing them travel all the time. What am I missing?
Yeah.
And I know in the Avengers, they say the dark magic thing, which is cool.
Yeah.
But now they're just going back on the Bifrost.
Which is weird actually, because I think I had always thought, oh, well, they've had enough time to rebuild it, but no, because we're seeing Loki come right back from Earth here.
Yes. When did they do it?
Right.
Yeah. So that's a plot hole, I think. That's not even a plot question. Another just really practical question. This is so dumb. But how long have the dark elves been asleep? How long are we led to believe?
5,000 years, I think is the...
How, this is what I can't get my mind around. How is their technology still so good if they've been sleeping for 5,000 years? So we're led to believe that Asgard hasn't developed anything new in 5,000 years. How is their cloaking still so good 5,000 years later and their weaponry?
That's a good question.
Did you think about that? It's so random. It's 5,000 years.
You know what I thought about that was even...
They wake up and they're instantly dominant. What?
I had a more basic question, which was just, why did they wake up?
Yeah, because the ether's been summoned and touched again.
Right,
and
but
think
what?
They just sense it.
But why?
Why is Gamora? Okay, explain to me really briefly the ether and the reality stone. When does it get turned into a stone? How is it a stone?
Right.
Instead of a sludge? Why is this the only one that's a sludge? Explain it to me. I'm asking. I don't know.
Okay. So I actually kind of compiled the lines that we get about the ether. I think the idea here is just that in the same way that the space stone is housed within the Tesseract, and you see Thanos and Infinity War crush the Tesseract and pull the gem out, I think it's the same situation with the ether in some way. I mean, we don't see that scene happened in Infinity War, probably because I don't know how they would have gone about making that look natural. But
yeah.
I think it's a little confusing to me because they didn't do much to make the ether act here like the Reality Stone will act in Infinity War. I would have liked to see a little bit more continuity there. But I do think the idea is that in the same way that you see reality altered in Infinity War, that Malekith is trying to use it to kind of eradicate light, which I guess would be altering reality. I think they focus a lot on it as a force of destruction and power, which feels a little bit too similar to the Power Stone that we're going to be introduced to next episode. But I think that...
Right, the version we get of it with Thanos is cooler to me.
I think so too.
That you alter reality, that stuff.
Does that answer your question though?
It does. It's a little bit of a, okay, that's a little bit of a stretch. Just that one's a little bit different.
I think one of the things that's frustrating to me is with Avengers and with the Space Stone and what we find out is the Mind Stone, they had to do a little bit of retconning to make those into Infinity Stones. It's frustrating because by the time we get to Thor: The Dark World, we knew, I mean, Kevin Feige knew that they were moving towards Infinity War, and I would have liked to have seen them have a little bit more continuity here, or maybe try a little bit harder to sort of paint each stone as distinctive. I think a great example of that is Doctor Strange, which I think is really the one movie where it's like, okay, this is what this stone is. This is what it does. These are kind of the rules. You know what I mean? I think other than they're all very vaguely powerful.
Right. And so then my last side note, then we get into what didn't work, is Asgard is so powerful and strong, and they kind of are painted as these divine creatures above everyone else. Why would somebody that smart give the Reality Stone to the Collector? I mean, the guy is obviously, anyone with any kind of street smarts, he's a weirdo. That's maybe not the best place to host it. I just, come on, like, give it to somebody else.
Yeah.
There's got to be a different planet that's a little more worthy than the Collector.
That's a good point. I mean, I guess maybe...
It's such a stretch.
I mean, I don't know, though. We don't know kind of what the reputation is.
He's a weirdo.
Well, sure.
That's all you need to
know.
Sure,
but I feel like maybe the understanding is that he is some sort of intergalactic... You know, vault keeper, banker. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Boogly, 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 like Guardians. No, because they walk in there and they feel weird. So they feel what I feel.
Well, no, I mean, they feel weird, but still maybe it's known as just being a safe place to house valuable things. I would say, I mean, maybe Thor would have thought to put it on Earth, you know, under the protection of the Avengers or something, but...
Probably anyone but the Collector at this point, but yes, I agree. Okay, what doesn't work? I have to start with what doesn't work 101.
Okay.
They break the massive rule. The villains we've talked about a million times. I'm not going to beat this to death, but is this the worst villain? Is this the least amount of motivation we get for a villain? I mean, the guy literally just wants to end the entire universe.
It's a contender for sure.
It's a contender.
I was thinking a lot about this and I can't decide if Malekith or Whiplash is the worst villain, but I think I'm going to give it to Malekith. I think he is the weakest MCU villain.
We might need to post that as a poll on social media. Worst villain, and give him four options with those two being the head candidates. The only thing I can resonate with is maybe just by bringing it into darkness, he feels more comfortable. And that doesn't necessarily mean killing everybody. I don't know. Is it, would everybody die if they bring it into true darkness? Is everyone dead?
I would think so.
Then what are you doing? Why?
Except for the dark elves, I guess. That's the weird thing is I guess since they're, but the crazy thing is their home. I don't know. It's all very confusing.
What is their home? Their home is awful, first of all. So it all goes into darkness so they can just sit in the darkness? I don't get it. It's let's not go crazy into this. It's not a good villain. No,
but,
it's one of the
but
worst.
But I do just want to ask one more question to the minds behind these first two Thor movies. Why is virtually every realm that isn't Asgard or Earth so bleak?
They're so awful, every one of them.
Like, I don't, it's like the Frost Giants are just sitting there really cold, just staring at nothing all the time. And the Dark Elves' home is just sand that's kind of blowing in the wind.
And it's really cloudy and just black.
Right.
It's really awful. Well, I'm fired up to talk about our next movie, but that's what is such a stark change in this viewing order of what Guardians of the Galaxy 1 does. Oh, all of a sudden we get all these planets that are teeming with life and culture and actually are a little bit desirable.
That's true. That's true. That's a good point.
Like, for example, the Nova Corps seemed like a very like noble planet. That could be maybe where you would decide to drop off the Reality Stone.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
But anyways, yes, this movie always paints every other realm as awful.
I do want to say briefly, as kind of my comic book nerd shout out, it's really unfortunate.
Here we go.
It's really unfortunate that Malekith was a poor villain here, because Malekith is a really fun villain in the comics and arguably Thor's best villain other than Loki, who is more of like an anti-hero a lot of the time. In the comics, the version of Malekith we get is almost like a Joker type character. He's insane and he's sadistic and he's kind of horrifying. And I think that if we had had, well, certainly a different take on the character, different casting for the character, I would have loved to have seen that. We get a little bit more of that in Hela in the next film. But
ooh, she's great.
She's great. But it is just a bummer to me, because for anyone that has read him in the comics, and I'll post some comics that you could read if you want to see what that character can be, it's a real disappointment the way that he's interpreted here.
Well, that's one word I would use for it. Disappointment, that's for sure. One last big picture thing, and then you take this and run with it. Anything else you feel like doesn't work?
Yeah.
I feel that from this point in phase two until really about the beginning of phase three, Marvel fought an uphill battle against, why don't these characters call each other? Now I understand they all live in the same universes. So when troubles arise, you have to explain to me why people aren't a phone call away. So you have three options. You can either put them all in the movie together, or you can just give me a comment of why they aren't there, or you can show me why they aren't there. So for example, this movie kind of kicks that off, and you're going to hear me complain about this in Iron Man 3.
Right.
The London scenes where they're in London and the galaxy's about to end.
Right. Right.
A phone call to Tony Stark maybe would help.
Right.
Or a phone call, like, oh, we're dealing with a bunch of science-y stuff. Maybe Bruce Banner. Like, maybe we call Tony and Bruce to help with the science part and a fight.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point.
Like, you're on Earth. There's a phone over there. You know where they are. So that's just a hurdle. Iron Man 3 has this problem.
Yeah.
There's a lot of other things that, you know, and even Ant-Man at least gives me a shout out where he says, why don't we call the Avengers?
Right.
That's all I need.
Right.
That's all I need. And so this movie kind of starts that for me. And phase two in general struggles with it, I think.
Well, I think this movie struggles more with it than Iron Man 3. I think there's at least a better case to be made for Tony being isolated in Iron Man 3. But here, you're right. Thor,
once he goes back to Earth, I mean.
Right, right. I mean, because the thing is, it's not just that he comes down and the battle's happening, because then you can maybe say, oh, well, he just didn't have time to call anybody.
Right, but he gets that's down what I mean.
And he goes to Jane's apartment, and they're strategizing and stuff.
Exactly.
You would definitely
phone call to Bruce.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a problem.
But Marvel becomes aware of it.
Totally.
And they pay the money they have to make it work going forward after a few movies. Because, like I said, in Ant-Man, you get the shout out. That's at least aware of it.
Right.
And then you start getting movies like Thor Ragnarok, where it explains why Hulk is with them. And Spider-Man Homecoming, why Tony's in the movie, right? They start doing it amazingly well.
Right.
But for this little glimpse for a few movies, it's like, okay, I can't buy it.
Yeah, and I think that it's always fun to kind of watch through these different eras that largely correspond, but not always, to the phases, to kind of see, you're right, the different challenges that Marvel was faced with and the ways that they've overcome them. Because I do think that, I mean, one of the things—
I actually think it's probably a challenge they didn't anticipate when they started.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's so impressive to me that for the most part, these movies just get better as they go. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, typically, sequels get worse.
Yeah, like, that is not a given. Like, we kind of treat it as that now because Phase 3 movies were all so great. But generally, when you look back on major film series, there's right. always kind of reverence for the first, and then it always kind of goes downhill. But that is not what's happened here.
If you tracked all of our scores at the end of this on like a graph, you would see just a general trend of it going up.
Oh, absolutely. I think, I mean,
there's obviously standout movies here
sure,
and there,
sure.
good or bad. But,
I think the bulk of my top 10 is all post Age of Ultron, you know, so it is impressive in that regard.
What else didn't work for you with this movie?
Yeah, so I just had one more thing, and I think maybe this is a symptom of the larger issue, which is just that this plot doesn't really make any sense.
Just one other tiny thing. The plot is total garbage.
It really is. And I mean, that's the thing is everything that I've said that I love about this movie are moments and dialogue and kind of bits of character development, which I think are all surprisingly strong. But the reason nobody ever remembers those moments
yes.
is because the plot yes. of this movie is incomprehensible, Kyle.
You have done a really good job of making me aware of the differences in these films. Because, you know, this is a movie that people would always bash, but you would always say, like, there's some good parts to it. And what I'm realizing is you're correct. Some of these movies, this movie does a better job in a lot of ways with character development
right.
and some of the quippy lines and some of the funny parts and some of the action scenes are better than a lot of the other ones.
Yeah.
But the plot itself is what people look at and go, yeah, but the whole reason we're watching the movie is to hear this story.
Right.
And the story is garbage. Like, even the villain, bro, it's garbage with the villain. And how they can stop this crazy cosmic event from happening by just using these little right. metal spikes? What?
No, my other... Okay, Kyle, just maybe you can explain this to me. Maybe I...
The convergence.
Okay, yes.
Is happening.
Okay. What is the convergence?
all the universes align.
Okay.
For one moment, they all align.
So here's my issue, is that early on, we have this moment where Heimdall is supposed to be setting up for us what the convergence is, right? Do you know the scene I'm talking about?
Yes.
And he tells Thor, you know, this only happens once every 5,000 years, and there's this line that I cannot for the life of me figure out why it is in the movie, where he says, but most people won't even notice it unless you have the, you know, the right way to see it. But it is obviously a very noticeable thing.
There's a giant cosmic rift in the sky.
Right. Everything is flying everywhere. And yeah, you can see through 9 dimensions from the middle of London. I don't know what part of that
okay, question,
is hard
question,
to...
Okay, question, because I know this is funny, but... It's hard to see. This is funny, but is that because of what Malekith is doing?
See...
Like, that's not the typical convergence.
I don't know.
I think.
That's my question to you. I don't know, because what...
That was an abnormal convergence,
but
which is already a very abnormal event, but...
But what can Malekith do to make that, is that with the ether? Because I thought the whole point was that he needed the convergence to happen so that he could make
no
the
sense.
Ether go. You know what I mean?
No
it
sense.
Just doesn't. But my whole thing is that's fine. I mean, well, it's not fine. It's still bad. But even if it's going to, if that's the route they're going, I just don't know why tell us, oh, you know, it's this like really subtle thing that happens, but it's really beautiful. And then show it being this just cataclysmic, nearly world-ending event.
Universe-ending.
Right, universe-ending. And I just love this idea that Heimdall's up there like...
It can be defeated by a human right. scientist by throwing pegs at people and then twisting a knob?
Right.
What?
Right.
That's how we stop it? We can separate them?
It just cracks me up because I like the idea that Heimdall's just up there in Asgard looking down like, oh, I'm the only one that can see this.
Also, with the convergence... Why does it always have to take place on Earth?
Right.
this cosmic galactic event, it always somehow ends up on Earth.
Right.
Can't he do that from anywhere else?
It's just funny. And also, it's funny that, of course, I mean, and you know, this is just, again, plot stuff, but not only does it take place on Earth, but of course, of all of the people in the world that could stumble into another dimension and find the stone, it's Jane Foster.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right. It's not good. Did you feel like Jane took a step back? I think Jane is the only character that's better in Thor 1 than Thor 2.
I 100% agree. Yeah.
The chemistry between her and Chris Hemsworth got worse. And maybe it's like the quippy dialogue we're talking about that she doesn't fit into. When she's more like trying to figure it out and kind of in awe of these weird things, it's cool. But her trying to be funny doesn't feel as natural for some reason. I don't know why Thor and her, Jane's chemistry gets a little worse.
Yeah. So this is one of those things that I don't know how much this has been blown out of proportion, but for years, the rumor has been that Natalie Portman almost kind of intentionally tanked her performance here.
Really?
There was a lot of drama around this movie, I think maybe more so than any other Marvel film, because Natalie Portman was really supportive of the original director for this film, which was Patty Jenkins, who directed Wonder Woman. And there was a dispute between Patty Jenkins and Marvel, I think just kind of a creative difference thing, and Alan Taylor was brought on. And the rumor is that Natalie Portman, you know, kind of gave the finger to Marvel from that point forward, which I think is why she was kind of off the table until very, very recently. But I don't know if that's the case.
It's a step back.
But I certainly feel, if that is the case, then I would say she succeeded.
Yeah, congratulations. Hey, so that's about it, Robbie. But I just got to say one last thing. The Loki magic stuff, there is no rules at this point. Whatever. We've talked about in other movies. But the cutting off the hand, that it really looked like he lost his hand. Then he can just come back. And, you know, it's just, I get it. He's got magic. But set some boundaries, please.
Yeah.
I actually think storytelling-wise, that magic and them breaking the rules actually ruins a cool moment, which is the Loki reveal at the very end of the movie where he's sitting in as Odin is supposed to be this really shocking, like, oh! But instead, for me, what it does is it makes that character development between Thor and Odin, it doesn't exist because he was actually talking to Loki.
I agree.
So that kind of ruins that moment. And the reveal is like less a cool reveal and more just like, oh gosh, here we go again. He's still alive.
Right.
And I think they meant it to be like a, oh wow, you know,
yeah,
crazy cliffhanger ending. Instead, I was like, bleh, boring. He's still alive. He can't die.
Well, and it's funny how that is dealt with pretty quickly in Ragnarok. Like it was set up here as though it was going to be kind of the thing driving the plot in the next film, and it's addressed within the first 15 minutes. Because obviously,
right, so question with that is, where is Odin at that moment when he's in the throne? Where's Odin?
I think Odin at this moment is in that nursing home.
Yeah, I guess. So I guess we're meant to believe in that amount of time he already left Asgard. That's just, it's,
yeah, I don't know.
It's not the cliffhanger I want. That's all.
You know, and that's something that we'll talk about again a long way from now, sort of after our technical endgame rewatch, but it's another issue that I have with Far From Home, where I think some of these reveals where it's someone isn't necessarily who you thought they were, they're cool moments, but I think that they can end up undoing a lot of,
ooh,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
A lot of whatever you've been given in the scenes prior to that reveal. And it almost makes it feel like those scenes are pointless to me. And I hate that.
Right.
I would have much rather had an after the credits scene where we could still have that be a real Odin Thor moment. And then find out that later at some other point, Loki has come back. And another thing that I just notice every time I watch this movie, I don't know why they showed Loki transform into the Asgardian soldier on the planet. Because then we just know it's coming. Like, wouldn't that, in terms of making a cool reveal, wouldn't the reveal have been much cooler if we had no idea how he got back and then they had to explain to us later? You know what I mean? Instead of them walking us through like we're a toddler.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is going to lead us perfectly into ranking the movie then.
Yeah, so we've already talked about a lot of the things that are big moving forward, and that I think a lot of the things that work here work only because of their significance moving forward. But one thing that I think we have to point out is this is the movie that gives us the concept of the Infinity Stones.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's the first time we ever hear that phrase. It kicks off really the rest of the MCU in a certain sense. I think it's really funny that the film that introduces the Infinity Stones is the most forgettable film in the Infinity Saga.
That's true. One last interesting tidbit for me, and I want the audience to hear this because I think they'll appreciate it.
Okay.
So Robbie and I did an episode on the Avengers, and I went on for about 10 minutes about how did they not call the military in for help? Like, this Battle of New York's happening, and why don't they scramble the jets? It makes no sense to me.
We get jet scrambled.
But we, I know, Robbie, my reveal is, to the audience, we talked about this for like 10 minutes, and I totally deemed it as totally not an interesting topic for you to hear. So I cut it out of the Avengers episode. So there's no jets talk in the Avengers episode. But I thought you'd appreciate that backstory, knowing that I wrote down, they scrambled the jets in this movie. I didn't realize that. But thank you. That's amazing. In Thor Dark World, when they're under attack in London, there are jets scrambled. They did it.
I thought about you whenever I saw that. I feel like they did that just for you, Kyle.
I thought you would appreciate that because I did cut it out. But know that I was passionate about the military being called in.
There you go. There they are.
Okay, so let's rank this movie.
All right.
I need people to know that originally I had this movie as like a 50. So I'm coming from, this is the lowest of the low.
Yeah.
The worst movie in the MCU, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to move it up all the way to a 72.
Oh, wow.
Which is a massive, massive jump. It is now movie number 21 of 23. It is only ahead of Hulk and Thor 1. It is 1 point currently behind Captain Marvel, just because I don't think I can put it ahead of Captain Marvel.
Right. Right. No, Captain Marvel's a better
movie. 72 for me, which I just spent so much time saying things I liked about it, but 72 is an appropriate score, I think.
Yeah, I think it is too. It's higher than Rotten Tomatoes gave it.
Yeah, true.
Rotten Tomatoes, by the way, scored this at 67%, I believe, which is...
Right, but I noticed that the audience gave it 76.
Yeah, that's
so
interesting.
So I'm kind of right in the middle of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually think this is the lowest rated movie on Rotten Tomatoes, right? I think it's under The Incredible Hulk.
Again, other than the stupid audience score from
right.
Captain Marvel.
Oh, right, yes. Right. Okay, so for me, I almost took it to the same place as you, although I gave it a slight bump. So for me, Thor the Dark World has a 73. And part of why I did that, and you're going to fight me on this, is I gave it a slight edge over Iron Man 2.
Oh.
So I have...
Can I just say something? It is like a more important movie than Iron Man 2, I think, in a lot of ways.
I really debated between these two movies, which one I thought was better, and even going back to the Whiplash versus Malekith thing, because they both have some big issues plot-wise. But I think ultimately, I think this one actually moves the ball forward on some character development. And I think in retrospect, while Iron Man 2 introduces a lot of new concepts and characters that that will, you know, just are kind of put into the toy box, we don't get a ton of actual development in that movie.
But the plot and the dialogue is better in Iron Man 2, in my opinion. Justin Hammer's funnier. I still like Tony and Tony and Pepper's chemistry. I think it's a little bit better, but obviously I ranked it higher than you in the first place. So I'm not going to fight you on it. It's not like Iron Man 2 is way high on my list. So.
No, I know. It's a really...
But yes, this movie is more important. Just the plot is total garbage.
It is, yeah. It is. So for me, I keep saying this, I think, because my list is shifting around. So people are going to be very suspicious of my numbering, I think. But right now, again, I have Thor the Dark World as number 20 of 23.
So the same as me, but one ahead of Iron Man 2.
Correct. Yeah. So I think the big things for me is I have it ranked above Iron Man 2 and ranked above the first Thor. So
me too.
Yeah.
I don't understand the first Thor being ranked higher other than it was just the first time we'd ever seen that. That's the only reason I can think that you would think that movie is better.
Yeah. I think this is, and to be fair, I think that movie probably has a more coherent plot. No, it definitely has a more coherent plot. But
yeah, it does.
For me, I think ultimately I would rather feel comfortable with the iteration of the character and the interactions and have a bad plot.
Interesting.
Than vice versa.
Interesting.
I really do think Thor is a more well-constructed narrative, but I just, whenever I watch that, I don't feel what I want to feel from the character of Thor or really Loki, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Well, our next rewatch episode.
Should we even keep going though? I mean, we've already sort of reached the pinnacle here, Kyle.
No,
I just wanted, I just wanted to get to Dark World. We made it.
Ooh, Dark Elf, scary. Ooh. So as always, guys, thank you so much for listening. Wherever you're listening and however you're listening, we are so grateful for you. Don't forget, you can get your Friends From Work t-shirt on theffwpodcast.com, as well as message us through theffwpodcast.com, where we try to go through those. And we are on all social media at the FFW Podcast, where we kind of announce some fun graphics, post some fun pictures, and just like to stay in touch with you guys there. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If you leave us a review on Apple, it really helps us out, and we appreciate that. We always say all those things, but we still really, really mean them. And so thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts, and we'll see you next time on Friends From Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.